This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Fires are connected with deforestation. Most of them were criminal fires. So they were a kind of burning the forest to raise cattle or to try to plant something.
The Amazon is burning. And we're not talking about the ubiquitous online store, although profit and commerce are just as involved. According to preliminary data from the Brazilian National Institute for Space Research, known as IMPI, deforestation of the Amazon rose 92% in the past year to 2,472 square miles, an area larger than the state of Delaware. And these fires, while posing a grave risk for wildfires, are not naturally occurring. These are for-profit fires, intentionally set and on the rise, fueled by a right-wing government hostile to environmental interests. This week on Sea Change Radio, we get an inside glimpse into this environmental disaster with Brazilian environmental journalist Carla Mendes. A contributing editor to Manga Bay, Mendes explains how the new right-wing government in Brazil has paved the way for deforestation and exploitation by big business in some of the world's most pristine rainforests. Then we cast our net to the archives and hear from sea forager extraordinaire Kirk Lombard. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Carla Mendes. She is a Brazilian-based journalist, and she's the contributing editor for Manga Bay. Carla, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, hello. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk to you.
No, we're very excited to get your perspective on what's happening in Brazil with the Amazon and this environmental crisis. Maybe you can kind of give our listeners who aren't familiar with the fires and the general situation there, kind of a brief overview.
Yeah, well, the fires in the Amazon, they started happening, we can say, almost 2 months ago, but it caught international attention a month ago, we can say, after the skies of São Paulo, it's Brazil's largest city, was completely dark at around 3 p.m., which is not usual. And then after that, we could see a lot of international attention and media outlets, NGOs, and internet other governments requesting action from far-right President Jair Bolsonaro to act. Because before that, the fires were happening, authority was demanding action, but the government just said that, well, the fires are not that bad. For the numbers, we couldn't see that's worse than other year compared to other years. So the first story that we reported at Manga Bay, for example, we used a technical note from an NGO called IPEN, and they connected the fires to deforestation. They, through the data they used and they could collect, they could show that where the fires were the worst is where when we could see the highest deforestation rates. So basically it means that in the areas, they cleared the areas and after that farmers set fire on the area to prepare the area for farming.
Yeah, so when we hear the term farmers, it's a little deceptive here in the U.S. because we see headlines like, why are Brazilian farmers burning the rainforest? It's not really just some farmer with his cow and growing a few ears of corn. These are huge multinational agribusinesses, right?
Yeah, you're right. Even though sometimes they use small farmers, you know, they are not sometimes the big guys, they are not at the forefront. And then they use small ones to act on their behalf. And even the big farmers, they try to get small farmers into the wrongdoing they're doing. For example, well, you're right, but it's connected. But yeah, but I think the agribusiness sector, that's the powerful agribusiness edge in Brazil.
And this is a rainforest. So when we hear about the Amazon being on fire, we think of this as a place where there's just an unlimited amount of moisture. But how is this possible from an environmental standpoint that it is catching on fire? Is this just because of deforested land, or is part of the actual rainforest itself on fire, Carla?
In this time of the year, what we call the dry season, it's starting, we call the dry season in the Amazon. Fire occurrences are normal to a certain point. But what we could see is that these fires were part of it, they were criminal. There is an ongoing investigation from federal police and other authorities called Investigating the Day of Fire. And there was even a WhatsApp group where farmers called other farmers to set fire on the forest to support President Jair Bolsonaro. Because just for you to have an idea, because there is since Bolsonaro took office, there has been a huge clash between environmental defenders and the government, because the government wants to open up an indigenous land and protected areas to development, including mining and agribusiness. And Bolsonaro was highly supported by farmers, miners. So there is we call Bancada Ruralista, which is a kind of a farming lobby at the Congress. And then they supported Bolsonaro, and now they are kind of requesting changes in the environmental laws and other measures to allow economic activities in the Amazon. And so there's a huge, huge battle down here between environmental protectors and agribusiness, mostly agribusiness leaders.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Carla Mendez. She is a contributing editor for Manga Bay. And you're based in Rio de Janeiro, right?
Yeah, I'm in Rio.
So we were just speaking about agribusinesses in the Amazon and how that's leading to these fires in many ways, that these self-inflicted wounds, if you will, to the land. I've heard some American politicians, most notably Beto O'Rourke, who has kind of connected the dots with Donald Trump's trade war with China. And he was saying how this is hurting farmers who usually will be selling their soybeans, let's say, to China. China is not buying them now. And so there's a new opportunity for agribusinesses in places like Brazil, and it's leading to some of this deforestation. Maybe you can expand on this dynamic. How is the U.S. trade war affecting what you're witnessing in your country?
Yeah, now, of course, this U.S.-China trade war has been having some impact here because, as you know, Brazil depends on agribusiness and to export commodities mostly. And when the U.S. said it, you want to sell soybeans to China, so China depends on it. And China has huge interest in Brazil. I've reported before about, you know, their interest in everything in Brazil, and soybeans is one of them. And then the government may have seen an opportunity to expand, and the agribusiness leaders to expand the Brazilian soybeans production to export it to China.
So Germany has cut about $40 million in environmental funding to Brazil. They're not pleased with the direction that their investment has gone in terms of you know, there's rising deforestation rates and all these anti-environmental policies of President Jair Bolsonaro. So first, explain a little bit why Germany did it and if this should be troubling to environmentalists.
Well, Germany has been supporting environmental projects in Brazil for a long run. And when it gives money to Brazil, the goal is to help to protect the environment. But then what we saw this year is that deforestation rates are higher and higher. And then after that, Germany decided to cut to, you know, withdraw this money to Brazil because Brazil was not complying with its promise to defend the environment. And we also saw Norway cutting back some money to the Amazon Fund because there are two different things, the Amazon Fund and the other environmental projects that are carried out a part of this. And we reported, we at from Mongabay reported on this as well, and many projects are at risk, and not only deforestation and conservation projects, but this money was sent to, for example, indigenous communities, river dwellers, and other traditional communities to help them to protect the environment in a way that, you know, they preserve or they can set up a kind of micro supply chain in the area, you know, to survive from native products like acai or cocoa or something like this, but now it's all at risk. And beyond the financial struggle itself, it also triggered a political clash between Brazil and many European countries. For example, after Germany cut this funding, Bolsonaro said, "We don't need your money." And then you, through this money, are trying to, you know, to interfere in Brazil's sovereign in the Amazon, because Bolsonaro has also been criticizing NGOs a lot and criticizing their interference. And before that, he also rose some suspicions about how the disagreements have been managed. It's a very complicated and worrying situation.
Quem mostrava esse caminho longe? Quem mostrava esse caminho longe? Esse caminho passou também. Mostrava esse caminho longe, quem mostrava esse caminho longe, esse caminho passou também. Saudade, saudade, saudade desse minha terra, sunny cloud. Saudade, saudade, saudade desse minha terra.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Carla Mendez. She is a contributing editor for Manga Bay. So, Carla, and you wrote a piece that entitled "The Future of Amazon Deforestation Data is in Doubt as the Research Head Was Sacked." So when we're looking at the smoke and the environmental impact of all these fires, it must be a little troubling that the government head in Brazil it seems like that's, if they're not delivering good news, that their job is at risk, or is there something else at play here?
Yeah, no, you're completely right that there is a lot of pressure arising from the presidency over this, the ministries and the environmental agencies. You know, I've talked to many of them off the records, and everyone who does a good job is very concerned about doing it. But in the case of INPE, it was really clear because Bolsonaro and other ministers challenged the data. And then the former INPE he said, "No, our data is accurate." And it's confirmed by scientists, researchers, and even other institutions who track deforestation. I talked to many of them, and all of them said that, you know, INPE is a reference. It has the best system, monitoring system in the tropics, and many systems were set up inspired in INPE data.
Just for our listeners, INPE stands for it's the National Institute for Space Research, right? Even though it stands for, my Portuguese isn't very good. So it's Instituto Nacional de Pesca. That's where I'm going to mess up. What did you say?
Instituto Nacional de Pesquisa Espacial. Yeah, but the translation you did is correct.
Yes, so that's what INPE stands for. And that is that the equivalent of the EPA in the U.S. combined with NOAA, right?
Because the forestation is just one thing that EMP monitors. It just monitor fires, it provide weather forecast and other service as well.
So the data we're getting, Carla, what does it tell us in terms of the impact that this tremendous amount of smoke and fire is having on the planet's atmosphere?
Well, actually, we look at, you compare the fires from this year to last year, it was much higher. But if you look at data from a longer period, we had, there were fires with, you know, at higher rates. It was worse in the past, we have to say.
So this isn't the worst year that we've had in terms of fires in the Amazon, but why is it newsworthy this time? Is it because of the deforestation that's happening, that this is much more man-made than just natural wildfires? Why is this a news story when we had bad fires in the Amazon 15 years ago?
Yeah, that's the point. This year, what researchers and NGOs found is that the fires are connected with deforestation. And as per other ongoing investigations, most of them were criminal fires. So they were a kind of burning the forest to raise cattle or to try to plant something. And beyond that, there was this organization, there was a kind of organized crime between agribusiness leaders to set fire on these areas. And another thing is that the government took too long to act. There were some reports showing that the government was asked to act to curb the fires, and it didn't until it triggered an international outcry.
So for listeners in the U.S. who are trying to follow what's happening in the Amazon, what are some of the kind of key benchmarks that you and your colleagues who follow this closely are looking for? When can we kind of breathe a little easier that maybe the fires have subsided? Or is this the new normal, Carla?
I think that the main fear down here is that this situation could be the new normal. If environmental enforcement is weakened, if the government don't provide money and support to environmental agencies and other watchdogs to keep an eye out on what's happening in the Amazon, because the situation isn't good, deforestation is increasing, deforestation is connected with fires. To prevent deforestation, you need to invest in oversight. So to try to deal with a situation like that when there's a huge amount of fire and deforestation is happening and it's done, you know, you need to act beforehand. That's why the alerts are very important, because the alerts provide you almost real-time information of what's happening in the area. So if you look at it very closely, you can see what's happening and from there send government officials there to see what's happening and then to seize illegal loggers, you know, to lead people to jail. If you don't act before and just to act after when the situation is dramatic, it's much more complicated. And I think that you did it very well saying that maybe the new normal if anything is done.
Well, people should follow you on Twitter. It's at Carla Mendez, and the work that you and your colleagues do at Manga Bay is a terrific resource to stay informed on what's happening in the Amazon. Carla Mendez, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Oh, thank you so much for the opportunity, Alex.
É samba de preto velho, samba de preto. Mas que
nada. Um samba como esse tão legal.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Kirk Lombard. He is the founder of Sea Forager Seafood Company. Kirk, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
So for our listeners, why don't you first explain how Sea Forager works?
Okay, well, it operates along the lines of sort of like a produce box, CSA delivery. People sign up online for a minimum of, I think, 4 deliveries. They pay a set rate, and then I choose based on what I think is most sustainable option plus what's the freshest. So, and then I provide that seafood. I deliver to various drop locations and also door-to-door service if it's requested. If it's in San Francisco, we can do that. So
what gave you the idea for this? Are there other
CSFs
around the country that do this?
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's I think a growing trend. Happily, there's a few other competitors in the Bay Area, but when you look at how many different seafood companies there are, I mean, there are dozens in California. There are way fewer people who define themselves as CSFs or fish delivery packages, and so there's less competition, which is one of the reasons that I was interested in doing it, just on a business level. The way Sea Forager started is that I do walking tours where they're very fishy, sort of fish-centric, seafoody, salty walking tours. I take people around various neighborhoods and on the coastline, and I teach them about the seaweeds that grow there and the monkey face eels that live under the rocks. And we practice how to throw casting nets so people can catch their own small fish using the Hawaiian casting net technique. And I demystify that because there's a lot of different people who teach how to do that online. And I have the simplest way to do it and the most effective. So I teach people how to go out and get stuff. And I was doing these tours for a couple of years, and I just started to notice that at the end of the tour, I'd get a lot of people who would ask me. They'd say, hey, so if I can't go out and throw a casting net and catch my own herring, or I don't have the time to go out and catch a perch on the coastline here or go fishing for stripers or whatever, how do I get something that I know is fresh and sustainable? So I was pointing them in various directions and just throwing a lot of business at various other, well, really there was only one or two different companies that I was really throwing people towards. And I just decided, well, since they're asking that question, why don't I provide the seafood? And with the contacts that I've made in the seafood world over the last 20 years, I've been able to do that. So, that's how it happened.
Take us back to that 20-year period a little bit. Give us a little bit of background. You have a very interesting past.
It's a hard one because I've worn a lot of different hats. So I've done a lot of different jobs over the years, and but the one thing that I always have done is I've always fished, mostly recreationally, and I've always just been in love with being out on the water or just along the shoreline, as it were. Most of the fishing that I actually do is shore-based. So like the things that I write about in my book the most are things like monkey face eels and night smelt and surf smelt and fishing from some of the piers in the Bay Area. And that's always been sort of my focus. As many different jobs and careers as I had over the years, the one thing that I always have done is been connected to the ocean in some way or another. And so I just decided at a certain point to commit to a life in seafood. I'm a true seafooditarian in the old Mr. Flood. That I'm making an obscure reference to a book by Joseph Mitchell, who has a wonderful, wonderful take on American seafood in the 1930s. You can read about it in a book called Up in the Old Hotel, but he has a piece called Old Mr. Flood, which describes a person who's just passionate about seafood. And Old Mr. Flood refers to himself as a seafooditarian. And so that's how I refer to myself.
And what is the problem with being a seafooditarian in today's marketplace if you're not
a conscious consumer in terms of what you're putting in your body and what you're doing in terms of supporting some of these less sustainable businesses. Why don't you explain how your business is kind of a reaction to some of the market inequities and inefficiencies?
If you don't have a conscience and you don't have a problem, you know, you can go do anything. But if you do have a conscience and, you know, you're concerned about the plight of the oceans and the seafood resources, you know, there's some very practical things that you can do.
So what is the flip side of your business? The people who actually are conscious about seafood are your consumers, but 99% of people don't even think about where their seafood comes from. Why should they?
One thing I've just always not ever felt like it's productive to tell people what they should do. So I do what I do. And if that appeals to people, hey, I'm more than happy to provide seafood. And what I do is I always have the name of the boat. I know when the fish was landed. I give details to my customers about how those fish were landed. I'm into the story. I'm into people knowing that what we provide on a weekly basis depends on a lot of factors. It depends on the skill of the guy going out and getting those fish. It depends on how big the swell is. It depends on what is migrating and what is available and what quotas have been reached. All of that stuff, if you're not attuned to that, then you come to think that it's just always there. And the problematic seafood, as I see it, is the stuff that's just always there. So a major component of what we do is to educate. And, you know, people don't sign up for Sea Forager unless they're open to that. You know, I every now and then I get somebody who writes me an email saying, hey, you know, I could have gotten such and such a fish for half of what you're charging. And then I say, well, first of all, how do you know that such and such a fish is even the species that you're buying? The New York Times did a study. What was it? It was either 40 or 60% of all American seafood is mislabeled to the species level. That is just insane. So you're buying tuna. How the hell do you know what you're getting? Anyway, so I let alone how it was caught, when it was caught, where it was caught, who caught it, how they were treated, how much they were paid for that. I mean, all of that stuff. Once that becomes a mystery, then it's just there's openings for, you know, the miserable treatment of the ocean and the fisheries. I try to take that mystery out.
He's the founder of Sea Forager Seafood Company, Kirk Lombard. Kirk, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Tom Zay, Cesaria Evora, and Tamba Trio. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.